The Motherhood Channel is your trusted source to provide in-depth information from UC San Diego experts focused on pregnancy, childbirth, and the first year of life. Visit uctv.tv/motherhood for more.
Good afternoon. My name is Anthony Duliba. I am the chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, also known as REI. And Dr. Su asked me to introduce the next session entitled Fertility and Infertility, but I think that REI is a lot more. So I want to give you kind of a general outline of what we actually do. So let's start from the R. It stands for reproductive health, which involves taking care of the landmarks of female lives across adolescence through menopausal transition and beyond. E stands for endocrine disorders of reproductive system. And the most common of these disorders include polycystic ovary syndrome, endometriosis, and disorders of menstrual cycle, such as abnormal bleeding. And finally, I stands for infertility and currently also for fertility preservation. So let me talk a little bit about R, reproductive health. It affects virtually 100% of women. It includes care for adolescents, transitioning to care of women during reproductive age, contraception, and assistance in conception when appropriate, and later on taking care of menopausal transition and developing the optimal treatments for hormonal replacement when ovaries stop working. Endocrine disorders of reproductive system are very, very common. The most common reproductive disorder in women is polycystic ovary syndrome, which affects up to 20% of women. And it has a lot of consequences, including consequences of high androgens, such as things like hirsutism or acne, as well as infertility. And now we know that it also includes consequences of metabolic problems such as dyslipidemia, insulin resistance, and now evidence of systemic inflammation. Finally, endometriosis can be causing lots of problems, including chronic pelvic pain and infertility, and it affects approximately 10 to 15% of women. What about disorders of menstrual cycle, abnormal bleeding or absence of bleeding? Abnormal bleeding affects up to 25% of women, and it includes wide range of problems such as dealing with uterine fibroids or other problems such as unexplained bleeding related to some subtle endocrine problems. Finally, what about infertility and fertility preservation? Infertility, when I was a student, infertility affected 10% of women. Now it affects approximately 20% of women, largely because they delay fertility for socioeconomic reasons. Fortunately, now we have growing programs such as fertility preservation, preservation of oocytes, of embryos, and in women who have no choice but have to preserve fertility because they are going to undergo treatment for cancer. And we have a very robust program dealing with oncofertility. Thank you, Irene. So, what are the challenges and future in our field? We have to keep working on better contraception choices with minimizing the adverse effect and adverse outcomes. We have to identify the best and safest hormonal replacement, balancing, again, risks and benefits. There's a lot of novel treatments coming on the horizon in treatment of conditions such as PCOS and endometriosis, especially including the role of chronic inflammation and the role of microbiome. And in our division, we have a very robust program dealing with this type of problems. We are working on improving our IVF outcomes, especially aspects such as genetic screening, preimplantation diagnostic tools, and so on. And at last but not least, we have other issues, not directly maybe medical science, but social sciences issues. We have a social and political challenges and barriers to care, including barriers involving finances, and access to care.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to see all of you in person and not in a little box. I'm a little, usually the radiologist in the dark room and the little box. So many of you are colleagues, collaborators, and friends, so it's really nice to have this opportunity, and I hope I make more colleagues, collaborators, and friends today, and introduce you to the rest of the radiology department. There's more than just me out there, I promise. Okay, so this is a very general title. They asked me for this title about, like, I don't know how many months ago, so we'll get, it's very general, but it's mostly about MR. That's my expertise. I'm an MRI physicist, and I'm a body and breast imager clinically. So let's get into it. These are my disclosures. There's lots of benign diseases and lots of malignant ones. I'm not going to dwell in this audience about any of those, but we'll go right to the pictures. We do read your notes. Sometimes, I'll qualify that, sometimes. So we appreciate it when you put your notes in there. This was not written by any OB-GYNs, but a general order, part of a note where a patient had pelvic pain. She was in her 80s. She had pelvic pain for many years, and the ordering physician had decided that he suspected psychiatric diagnosis. And this was one of our faculty. So I want you to know that this era has not left us. This was just a few years ago when I read this note and the chart. And there are actually ways. This patient had never had any pelvic imaging to evaluate for pelvic pain. So I'm glad he made his he put that in his assessment. And I want to talk a little bit about pelvic pain. It's a big problem. This is what this slide summarized. Pelvic pain is a big problem, but there are ways of evaluating it. And it's sort of one of the new areas that I'm branching into now is trying to, and Irene took me for a very long walk and we talked about endometriosis. I appreciated the encouraged exercise and science talk. So this is an area where I really think that radiology can collaborate with you guys in sort of exploring new avenues and solutions for evaluating pelvic pain, especially when we don't really know where it's coming from and having different modalities of evaluating it. So when I started as faculty, I met with Dr. Agarwal. This was one of his patients. And if you guys can see this little tiny, tiny white spot here on the uterus, that was representative of this whole mess that he saw in the operating room representing an endometriosis. So when on MR, when we're like tiny implants, and then you guys are like, oh my God, it was a hot mess and all these adhesions, and why didn't you see this? I was like, look, this is what I saw, okay? I'm doing my best. I'm doing the best I can. Your eyes are going to be better than anything I see. But I think that this is where we're making a lot of improvements. Some of the MR technology has really, really improved over the last couple years. We have a collaboration with GE where we're the site that's determining all of their MRI protocols that they're going to be using and distributing and trying to democratize imaging so that, you know, you can have experts determine the protocols and then them used worldwide wherever there's their type of scanner. So this is a T2 image. So whenever you hear a radiologist talk about T2 images, it just means like when water is bright and fat is bright if it's not suppressed. So on T2 images, when we're looking for endometriosis, we actually look for dark spots. So this dark area here and this dark area here, those are all endometriosis implants on the patient. And again, this one is that where we're looking at T1, that's where we can see active bleeding or blood. And so here you can see, so it's really tiny punctate little foci. And those are the words we use in our reports that you guys love so much. And that's representing the blood that you saw on that prior image very similarly. But you can see that the resolution has significantly improved over the years. And it's making our evaluation, you know, we're now down to sub-millimeter slices. So hopefully we don't skip over an implant as we're going through this and being able to evaluate it a little bit better. And, you know, a lot of you guys do ultrasound. And you know that one of the tricks that when you're looking for it is you push the probe down and see if the bowel is moving with the uterus or not, and that's a sign of adhesions. So we can do that. We don't have to push on the patient. We just let them do their thing. And their bowel movement actually helps us evaluate this. So if we do a CINE and evaluate bowel movement, we can see here that the rectum is actually adherent to the patient's posterior uterus here. And we're doing this in multiple planes. Here you can see that everything else is moving and it's stuck here on the bladder. And this is sort of a, this is our newest protocol. We are have recently rolled it out in the last couple months. We're now also giving glucagon to patients, which we haven't done before. It's a big nursing thing at UCSD to be able to deliver glucagon for an MRI and an MRI for a patient for some reason. But so we do this part very early in the evaluation, then we give glucagon so we can stop the bowel motion. Because bowel motion causes a lot of artifacts for us, and then we can't see these little tiny things, right? So that's what we're working on. This is a different cause of pelvic pain when you guys, not you guys, but people have sort of varicosities in the pelvis, and we're trying to figure out if that maybe is a cause of pelvic pain, because we can treat that in interventional radiology. We can coil reflux in the ovarian veins. So here, this is when we're actually able to evaluate, because we're taking images every 10 to 15 seconds, and we can actually see the reflux of blood going down the left ovarian vein before it goes up it. And then we can diagnose based on an MR without sending a patient to the IR suite that a patient has reflux in her left gonadal and may be a cause of pelvic pain and pelvic venous congestion. Although I know that's like a passe term, pelvic venous disorder, is it? Okay, so, and then this is another one. I know pelvic floor is a big deal, and we have a lot of room for improvement on how we do that, but this is a patient just demonstrating a cystocele here, where you actually see her bladder falling down simply by bearing down in the MRI scanner while we're imaging. And then this, again, is the little cine where we actually make the patient, we put stuff into the rectum, and then we make them defecate into the scanner. The olden days, we did fluoroscopy on these patients, and yes, there's a lot of value in doing fluoroscopy, to evaluate for issues with defecography and whatnot. But it turns out that we can't see all of the muscles when we do that. So yes, the patient is in her natural position while she's in the fluoro machine and we can image it, but we can't see the muscles like we can with MR. So in MR, the patient is not in such a natural position when she's defecating, she's laying on her side. But if the problem's big enough, we're gonna see it. And for most of these patients that are willing to do this exam, they're so happy and to do this for us. Because the if you can't go to the bathroom or have problems controlling whatever, you're not going to have a problem doing this. You want help. And I know that Mariana and I have been talking for a while, and we have a sort of a our latest, I have a proposal going in now for, you know, the next phase of protocols that we're working on, and pelvic pain with, you know, avulsion injuries, and further developing our defecography studies as part of the next protocol development that we're working on. This is a project with Luis Laurent and Mona Prost, and Anna Rodriguez Soto is our amazing project scientist, who is sort of the liaison and the person that makes stuff happen. So this is part of the HubMap project where Anna, I guess, grabbed the placenta after it was delivered and brought it to the MRI scanner, scanned it, and correlated it to the pathology afterwards. It's pretty cool. And it's hopefully going to help the study somehow in evaluating normal placentas. Okay, so let's move on to cancer. So this is where I spend a lot of my time is in looking at cancers. This is where most of the research that I do with your department is in gynecologic cancer imaging. Who's an engineer? Who are the engineers left? Okay, so this is for you. So diffusion imaging is really, really cool. And it's a technique that this specific technique called restriction spectrum imaging, where it was a technique that was developed at UCSD originally for brain imaging and looking at nerve tracts. But it turns out that you can use the same idea to look at cancer cells. The idea behind it is that cancer cells have large nuclear to cytoplasm ratios, and that water, and water is what actually we're looking at for the most part in MRI, water is stuck inside of large nuclei. So there's, you'll hear us, you know, radiologists are like, there's there restricted diffusion or is there not restricted diffusion, right? You hear us saying that. And then there's this thing called hindered diffusion. So there's free diffusion, which is like water moving, blood vessels flowing, that's free diffusion. Hindered diffusion is the water that's stuck in between tightly packed cells. So that's if you have edema from post-treatment stuff, whether or not You have infection that causes a lot of issues that look very similar. So that's hindered water. And then there's restricted water. And that's when we're looking really at the intracellular component. And we can separate that out with some cool math and modeling. And it turns out that for every organ, it's a little bit different. And so we have to understand sort of that the model. So when people are like, well, why don't you just take the prostate one and apply it to the ovaries? It starts making me twitch. It's, you know, it turns out women and men are different. And our organs are different too. And so and how cancer presents in our organs and how to identify it is also different. So this is the model that we've developed for cervical cancer treatment and evaluation. So with cervical cancer right now, the main way to evaluate response to radiation treatment is that you have to wait 4 months to get a PET CT. 4 months is a really long time to wait to see if someone's responded to treatment because of the post-treatment edema. So with this technique, we're able to separate out edema from active live cells and really identify what's left of cancer, which is cool. So this is a patient before treatment, and this is a patient after treatment, and you can see it's prettier than the PET images. That being said, I actually really want us to have a PET MRI at UCSD, but we don't have one yet. I think that there's a really great application for gynecologic oncology imaging because these patients are, you know, it's patients have to still get the PET and they have to get the MRI right now. It's really inconvenient. And it turns out that it would be really nice if we could do it at the same time because we get information if we're using this technique and this diffusion technique. We can get the information for the active cancer cells. We can also see the lymph nodes and do the staging. Since we don't have a PET MRI, I made some friends. I had a visiting scholar from Uppsala University in Sweden who came. She learned about the technique and then she brought it back to Sweden and we've been able to collect some really great data and I don't have to pay for it. So it's been cool. It's been a great collaboration and I think really has driven the point home that PET MR is not just a really expensive technology, it's just one that we don't have because it's expensive. So hopefully we'll be able to get it in the near future. Here, this is ovarian imaging. So this is a project that Mike McHale and I have a CureBound Award for, the Cure Prize. And this is looking at sort of evaluate. We made a model now for ovarian cancer. We're a couple years into the study. And this is a demonstration of what cancer looks like. And it turns out that we can actually look at the vascular flow too without giving contrast as part of this modeling, which is interesting for us to be able to have a different technique to look at vascular flow and vascularity without having to give contrast as well as the cellularity and the abnormal cells that are within cancer. This is breast cancer. And we're developing right now, one of the hot things out there is to try and develop a way to screen for breast cancer without giving gadolinium. So we now have this technology, which is we have less than 2 millimeter resolution to be able to detect cancer without giving IV contrast. In the future, we want to be able to predict tumor grade with imaging. We are collaborating with Dwayne Stupak in your department on doing tumor markers from those ovarian samples and looking at the genetics and looking at our vascularity and diffusion information and see if we can find some patterns that correlate to it. And I also think that we need to figure out different ways. I really want us to develop a technique to screen for ovarian cancer. And I know that's a spicy topic, but I do think it's a doable one. It's not 20 years ago. We have advances now. We should really try it again. And so that's sort of one of my current passion projects. This is the team we had. You guys will appreciate this. My team got me to get on a bike. We were called the Ovary Achievers. And we collaborate with like half your department. And thanks to everyone for their funding and for listening.
Thank you so much, and it was a great to hear Dr. Penner talk about, you know, show that slide with the, like, I think she's crazy, and that's what this disease is. I'm Jennifer Anger. I'm in the Department of Urology, also in OBGYN as an adjunct professor. I study reproductive age women, both cis and trans women, and I study incontinence in aging women, as well as prostate cancer in aging women, wink, wink. So today we're going to talk about interstitial cystitis and how we can use VA data sets to study women. This is a great example of how thinking that IC is a women's disease has stifled research in IC, and it actually has impacted the care for both men and women with IC. And the VA is a great place to study all populations. We have some gender-affirming care studies of veterans. And what's neat about it is you can have an administrative data set, which largely focus on only claims, but then we can go into the charts from identifying patients by claims data. So it makes it very novel. So as many of you know, painful bladder syndrome is an unidentified or without other causes, painful bladder, symptoms of bladder pain that it lasts at least 6 weeks in origin without causes such as a UTI. Classically, it's been said that 10 women to every one man have IC, but looking at VA data, we actually, with rigorous chart review, found that this ratio is only 1.6 to 1. And there's many gaps in care. We don't know what causes it. We really don't know how to treat it. Women are considered crazy. And so we're trying to understand roles of predictive that can predict outcomes, for example, PTSD, depression. And actually what we want to study are certain characteristics. How does exercise impact pain? Or how does pain impact our ability to exercise? So doing some work looking at including Fitbits. Also determining the impact of comorbid conditions such as depression, such as PTSD, which is higher in the veteran population on symptoms of bladder pain. And then also assessing the effect of possible disparities. Wait, we'll get off of this slide real quick. No, just kidding. We really do want to continue to study disparities. You know, there's this, you know, we've been kind of confusing DEI from disparities research, but what we really want to do is identify patients at higher risk of certain conditions. And we want to also be advocates for all of our patients. So here what we want to look at is, and some great work's been done, it might be temporarily halted in several areas of research, but looking at the role of area code, or what we call area deprivation index, not just the area code, but that 10-digit area code or neighborhood, how does that impact pain? What's really interesting is a vast majority of patients, so women in Long Island, 90% of women Caucasian had pain, who had painful bladder syndrome diagnosis of IC, actually had significant dietary sensitivity, meaning they would say, this bothers my bladder, this bothers my bladder. And so And so we're thinking, well, is this isolated to women? Is it women are thinking that their diet is bothering them when really it's not? And we actually looked at the same thing in men and women, a very heterogeneous population, racially and ethnically diverse population, and they also had very significant dietary sensitivity. So this is a sort of example where we want to really study both men and women, and then we can better identify diseases and hopefully help patients of both genders, or all genders. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My name is Shen Zhong. I'm in the bioengineering department. So my lab develops technologies that enable us to observe molecular and cellular phenomena that have not been seen before. These include, for example, single cell multi-omics technologies, AI technologies. And with those novel technologies, we generate big data from human specimen and patient samples. And we leverage modern AI to prioritize very specific concrete mechanisms, and we experimentally evaluate those mechanisms. And with proved novel mechanism, we aim to develop therapeutics to intervene. For example, Alzheimer's disease is impacting 1 in 9 people aged 65 or older. Unfortunately, 2/3 of those patients are women. And we developed technologies that would enable you to simultaneously monitor 3D genome structure, gene expression, RNA-RNA interactions, and RNA chromatin interactions from human brain, and analyzing Alzheimer's disease brains and control human brains, we discovered a hidden hallmark of Alzheimer's disease, that is widespread dysregulation of transcription in the Alzheimer brains. And we recently were able to prioritize and evaluate and validate a novel pathway leading to this widespread dysregulation in transcriptional control, and developing a therapeutic candidate that manifests dramatic improvement in cognitive deficits in different animal models of Alzheimer's disease. So that article is coming out in Cell next week. We have a desire to improve live birth rate in IVF clinics. And the idea is to do it via minimally invasive assays. So we discovered that human IVF embryos secrete many extracellular RNA from within the cell to the extracellular space. Working with Dr. Irene Su, we discovered a technique that is able to sequence the entire profile of extracellular RNAs from a tiny amount of liquid biopsy, including IVF spent media. So Irene actually were able to consent more than 60 infertility patient families harvesting IVF spent media from more than several hundred IVF culture. And we applied this SilverSeq technology to profile these spent media, generating the comprehensive profile of extracellular RNA. And leveraging machine learning, we were able to develop biomarkers that can predict the embryo quality to the same extent as embryologist's ability through imaging-based assessment. With that, I thank you for the opportunity. It's been always a pleasure working with folks working on women's health.